Hi guys, before we get started on this week's episode of Worst Foot Forward, we have an advert for a podcast that we both highly recommend to you. It is hosted by former guest of our show, Eric Lampere, who did our episode about the world's worst aliens. We're going to let Eric tell you all about his show, Topical Island.
Okay, Gregory, we need to do a little commercial to advertise our podcast. What should we say? No, not that. I'm not saying that. I don't want another letter of complaint. Shut up, Darren. I didn't ask you. Yeah, that'll do. Hello, my name is Eric Lampere. I do a podcast called Topical Island. Either alone or with a guest, and with the sentient animals living on my imaginary island, we dissect a topic to the best of our ability. Science, history, literature, any sort of nonsense. Topical Island is the perfect destination to get away from reality. So find us on Apple, iTunes, or SoundCloud. That'll do, right? Yeah. Good one. Oh shit, Naomi found us. Let's get out of here. Yeah, find us on iTunes and shit.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast where each week me, Ben Vanderveld, your co-host, Barry McStay, and our guests try and find the world's worst something. Freddie Mercury once sang, "One dream, one goal, one prize, one soul, one golden dream of what could be," and he was talking about a future England World Cup win. Or was he talking about a kind of magic? Yes, he was, because this is the podcast that this week has 15 dead dubs down its trousers, a mouthful full of disposable razors, and a studio full of smoke, mirrors, and three dead assistants. And this week, my wonderful co-host and beautiful assistant, who I've tried and failed to saw in half lengthways, is, as I said before, the wonderful Barry McStay. Hello, Barry.
Hey, presto. That was beautifully done, Ben.
Cheers, pal.
I love a Freddie Mercury reference. And I bet that our guests have never had anyone do an It's a Kind of Magic reference to them, ever.
No, it's the first. That's the first one.
First one ever.
I never even thought of it. That's a song with magic in the title.
There's your theme tune for the next Edinburgh show.
We'll use that. Why would you lie like that? Why would you just outright lie on a podcast? I think that's unfair.
Not true. You're not under oath.
No. I would love to see magic tricks done purely under oath.
That's just people doing things then, isn't it?
Listen, my friends, we're going to get right to brass tacks this week, because as you can probably guess, our show is all about magic, and we've got a lot to talk about, so I'm going to hand over to Barry to introduce our guests this week.
Yes, our guests this week are an Anglo-Welsh double act, very much the Severn Bridge of the magic world. As befitting young Victorian gentlemen of sartorial elegance and low ambition, both attended Oxford University, where they engaged in various studies of dubious merit. Their long-term goal being to avoid academia of any real vigour, they first encountered each other in a theatrical production best described as indescribable. They discovered a kinship based on waistcoats, tea, and magic tricks, thus embarking on a career of making people doubt what they're really seeing for money. Their latest bamboozling magic show, Time Travelling Magicians, is about to tour the UK, and you might know them from their numerous Edinburgh Fringe shows, as well as appearances on televisual extravaganzas such as Penn and Teller Fool Us, The Slammer, and The Next Great Magician. Why, wave my wand and cut my balls, is that prestidigitating pair, Rhys Morgan and Robert West.
Hello.
There they are.
All that from memory.
Yeah, all that from memory.
As ever,
I have been following your career so closely. I was one step behind you, and I finally got you right where I want you.
So how long have you boys been separately? How long have you been magicians for?
Separately and together is the same answer.
Oh really?
Like we started as a double act. We have never been solo magicians.
No.
Oh. Had you both been into magic before you got together?
Not really. So we met doing a production of Terry Pratchett's Weird Sisters way back in the dim and distant past. When did we start picking up magic? It was December of 2006, I think.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, something like that. Separately. And then we both realised that we were both sort of playing with cards and things like
both
that.
Both had powers.
Yeah, exactly. And spurred each other on to learn more and more dangerous powers as time went
as
by.
Time went on, yes.
Oh, you go against my my stereotype of magicians in my head was that, like, young men who were terrible at talking to women so took up magic at the age of 10.
Oh, no, that too. But we just remained terrible at talking to women right at the age of 20. And thought, why haven't we been doing magic this whole time?
Just have to legitimise your office
exactly.
Assault
exactly.
And a half.
And you did in a double act, you could do a pincer movement on the passing women.
You just say, outnumber them. That's not a good flirting tactic.
And if you turn around, my friend will also show you a card. It was awkward, actually, because it's a basic situation where you're both the wingman.
That makes the woman the fuselage.
Exactly, yes. But no, we didn't start young. So a lot of magicians start young and get into it as kids. We started technically old, I guess, about 20.
Mm.
But before we did magic together, we did plays together and we did shows together.
Did lots
together.
And lots of shows. And I think that's where the drive for doing the magic shows comes from, more than the magic itself, is the want to stand on stage and show off.
Yeah,
basically,
yeah.
Isn't it?
If it weren't magic, it'd be something else.
Yeah,
stripping or <don't> or I'd be a professional acrobat.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, stripping's very much similar to magic in that it's the art of concealing lots in not very much.
Exactly. Yeah.
Or in my case, the art of concealing not very much in not very much.
Did you have any magic sort of heroes? People that you looked up to once you started to get into it, are there specifically studied?
I used to really like watching Darren Brown on television when I was younger, and went to see his first two live shows as a muggle.
As a layperson,
as it were. Yes, the magic community have this awful, I hate it, that refer to sort of the lay audience.
Yeah,
I
the
hate
laity.
It. It's weird.
Oh, really?
Non-magicians. Scum.
Yeah.
That's what you
yeah.
That's what we call them. That's nice. Yeah. Coming in my house,
exactly.
I make your tea, offer you bloody after eights, and we're referred to as scum.
Exactly. Yeah. Best way to do it. And... and so I used to watch Darren, used to really like that. Obviously, I watched Paul Daniels when I was a kid growing up.
So I never really watched Paul Daniels. Like I have a few memories of a couple of bits he did on TV, but never really like watched it.
Mm.
I watched a bit of Darren, I watched a bit of Penn and Teller, and was kind of aware of them. But my older brother did magic, and so that was sort of his thing. And he did magic tricks. And so there was a point when in my 20s when I would be reading books on magic tricks and having flashbacks to my like 12-year-old brother performing them to me.
Oh, wow.
And because I remember like he used to do a version of the coins through table, which is where you drop coins through a table into your other hand. And I remember reading the method for that and being like, that's how he did it. This is how Dan did the coins through the table thing.
That's amazing. Like the ability to pick it up is still astonishes me. I remember when I was about 7 or 8 getting a magic book and I was like, right, I'm going to do a magic trick for my dad. So like marched into the living room and was like, right, Dad, pick a card, any card. Brilliant. There you go. Okay. Now stick it back in the deck. Lovely. Now wait there.
Yeah.
And then I'd leave the room, come back. I'd do the sleight of hand out of the room and then come back and go, and that's your card. Actually, God, do you have, like, because as a stand-up, particularly if I'm trying new material, I'm often on stage going, oh, I hope this is funny, otherwise I'm not my job description. How often are you on
we
stage?
We have that more than comedians do, because a joke can be a bit funny. A magic trick can't be a bit a magic trick.
That's true.
It's binary. It's a magic trick, it fools you, or it doesn't. If something happens and you can't explain it, that's a magic trick. And if you can explain it, it's not.
And if you have an entire show of 7 things in a row that you shouldn't be able to explain, but you definitely can, that's definitely not a magic show.
So then it's just a... Oh, no, that's it. That's what you've got. You've got nothing.
It's slightly shoddy interpretive dance that people are talking about. Like, it's, you know, it becomes weird quite quickly.
I would find it very difficult to get angry at you two failing to do magic in the way that I do get angry at Mr. Blaine and some of the other people we're inevitably going to talk about.
Yeah, before we do talk about them, we've got to ask you guys, either individually or collectively, whichever you like, what you are worst at in the world.
I am absolutely abysmal at names. despite having been a teacher for a while, and so I had to rapidly learn, you know, 30 kids' names a day for a week or something, I can't remember people's names to the point where we will go into a theatre and we'll meet the tech team and I introduce myself and I'll try all of the things about, you know, associate their name with someone that you know, say their name 3 or 4 times, and then 10 seconds later I'll turn around and I'll go,
Hey, buddy.
Hey, can you just, there's two of you standing there. That one there. you both look the same. Never mind.
There's a reason we call everyone dude. When we're just, hey, dude, can I have a light?
The point where I will actively put someone else's name onto someone, and I will imagine that they're called Steve when in fact their name is Jose or something.
Can you guys do hypnotism, though, to make them think that that's their name anyway?
I wish I could save you
from social embarrassment.
Yeah, it's as it is, it's just horrible.
Surely you can just do a mind palace.
But honestly, so this thing, but Reese has got an incredible memory for certain things. Like any venue we have ever been to, like any theatre we've ever played, Reese can describe to you. And not just like roughly what it looks like what the room's like, what the dressing room's like, how we got there, where we ate that day.
Wow.
Like I can't remember anything.
But
until
people...
I literally get there, I'm like, oh, this place.
I think I'm quite similar to you, Reese, because we'll host the show and someone will mention something and my brain will go, you know this random fact about Iceland or whatever.
Yeah.
But I genuinely... I'm going to fess up. I've literally pulled up your webpage to go, hang on, which one's recent, which one's wrong?
Yeah, completely.
Are you similar or do you have a different...
I'm actually pretty good with names. So I was going to say that my biggest weakness is stairs, because I am terrible at stairs. I'm not a stair fan.
Stairs that you climb, not stairs that you look at.
But actually, really, that does encompass most of the disabled community,
yes,
of which I am one. So that's kind of a general team thing. So actually, the thing I'm worst at is small talk. So again, it's the double act thing of I'm terrible at like meeting people in a non-professional way. So in a professional way, when we're talking shop or we've got to get into a venue and do lights and talk this and that, that's fine. But when it's just like, hey, this is so and so, I'm like, yep. and to the point of when I meet people, if they ask me what I do for a living. And I've been a professional magician for 6 years,
yeah,
full time. I say teacher. Because teacher is a boring job and no one wants to talk to you about it.
The difference is, though, that if you guys get in a taxi and tell the taxi driver what you do for a living, he doesn't immediately tell you how to do it better.
True. No, yeah. Here's one for you. Da, 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 da. Yeah. Yeah. So putting in silks out of his pocket.
All of a sudden, you got a black cab full of doves.
Oh my god. Like
Channing Pollock
totally
gave his axe to a
yeah, that's true.
That's totally a hidden camera show waiting to happen.
Ben Hanlon's probably already done it.
Yeah, so Ben Hanlon probably has done it.
Yeah, it's a wonderful idea. Also, like, if Uber want to get their license back, that's the way to do it. Just have illusionists.
Just change it to an entertainment license. Just
exactly,
have
yeah,
shows just, instead.
Yeah, it's not a cab service. They're not employees. It's a roving site specific theatre piece where you can join at various points.
Yeah, I mean, they'll probably have a stronger union if they do that as well.
You're
suggesting that Uber should sign up to the Magic Circle.
Yeah.
Or just equity in general.
Just equity in general. Yeah. Yeah. Fine, that'll cover them.
Well, are you in the Magic Circle?
No.
Is that a thing anymore?
So it's a real thing. So the thing in the Magic Circle...
Yeah, their offices is in Houston.
It is, yeah.
That's where you think they are.
It's also where they are.
It is also where they are,
Very, very unhappily, they have a sign on the door.
Yeah.
And a buzzer.
Yeah.
It's just the guy on the other side of the door. You don't really want to mess with him. So.
Yeah.
But
again, doves.
Combat doves.
Yeah. Self-defense mechanism.
Razor sharp cars. Just flinging them really hard.
But yeah, the Circle is, it's just a club. It's just like a line dancing club or any other club that sort of like old dudes go to on a Wednesday night. It's just that's what it is.
Yeah.
And it's the biggest magic club in the world, but it is just a club.
Yeah.
And so like the majority of members are amateurs. Part of the reason we're not members is that you have to pay a subscription fee every year that we don't want to pay because we don't live in London.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the reason we're not members is that we don't really want to have to audition for other people who determine whether you're good enough. Like, imagine if there was the Comedian Circle and a bunch of guys who haven't worked since the 70s are going to sit there in their bow ties with a clipboard and like
and
mark
have a
your
set
jokes
of rules
and have
by
a set
which,
of rules that you,
you
have
know,
to, a criteria you have to hit.
One of the rules is, you know, did the mother in law joke land and stuff like this.
Was smartly turned out. Like things that you have to hit. And it's like, we are at the stage in our career now where we wouldn't need to audition. We could just go look at our back catalogue of work.
And you can submit as an audition.
You can submit just a video of your show. Yeah. But we just aren't super comfortable with the idea of a bunch of people deciding whether or not we're good enough to be in the circle or not.
He says having judged a magic competition not
2 weeks
ago.
Having recently judged a magic competition.
Barry, tell me who your suggestion is for the world's worst magic trick.
Oh, in a bit, Ben. Be patient.
Okay.
I've done some reading around the subject, as ever. First things first, this, you'll probably know the sort of the name of maybe the earliest magician and the earliest trick that's sort of kind of accepted.
Yeah, Cups and Balls is probably the earliest recorded magic trick.
Yeah, Cups and Balls is on certainly being done in Rome by sort of their first century AD. There's a story, there's an engraving, an Egyptian engraving in a tomb at a place called Beni Hassan, which apparently has two guys doing the Cups and Balls trick. A lot of people say it's just two guys with a couple of cups, and we're sort of reading into this thing.
Two guys, two cups.
Two guys, two cups. Yes, the ancient Egyptians. And then, beside that, there's an engraving of someone watching the two guys, two cups, and their reactions of a shock expression.
What, is that Egyptian Gogglebox?
Yeah. There's a guy called Dedi, who's an Egyptian magician, who Ben is nodding at, who's recorded in the West Cork Papyrus. He may be a myth. He certainly seems to have existed, if he did exist, in about 2700 BC. And again, some people say he may have been doing the cups and balls trick. What he definitely was doing in the papyrus was doing the beheading a goose or beheading a bird trick and then putting the head back on. Again, the guys are nodding like, that's just an everyday thing you do. It's a classic trick.
It is a classic trick.
Is it as classic in the method that he seems to do, where the thing says he would decapitate a goose, place her head on one side of a chamber, and the body on the other side of a chamber, and then the body and the head would get up and waddle around and go over to each other and reconnect. That seems an impressive extra element to just, you know, making the head disappear.
This again does bring us back to the point of the best magic tricks are told in the remembering.
Yeah, I think that's probably
fair. I'm going to say that never happened. But that account would have been written by someone who heard the story secondhand.
Yeah.
As is often the case.
I reckon there's a good chance you could probably train a goose to do the necessary walk.
It's the head bit is the problem.
Yeah. but as in, without saying how the trick is done. Train the goose to walk
to a certain head, but yeah,
I mean, head goes under a wing, guys.
Exactly. Yeah.
Ben and I both know how that.
Yeah, we totally. Although I'm really enjoying for the rest of the podcast, you two speaking in code and avoid sharing too many secrets.
Yeah, you're right. I think this may be a second-hand account or third-hand account of Dedi, because apparently he was also 110 years old, would eat 500 loaves of bread and a shoulder of beef a day, and drink 100 jars of beer.
They were tiny loaves of bread.
Tiny jars of beer.
It's like Egyptian sushi.
He's like doing a centurion with a beer. Of course, back then, doing a centurion actually just meant doing a centurion.
Yeah, that's what Cleopatra called a night off.
I looked up the word abracadabra. It's been around since the first mention of it appears to be in the 3rd century AD in a medical book called the Liber Medicinalis by Quintus Serenus Simonicus, who was the physician to the Roman Emperor Caracalla. And apparently malaria sufferers would wear a charm with the word abracadabra arranged in that triangular formation. Have you ever seen? You guys will know. You'd often see it arranged with the A at the top and then AB and all the way down into a triangle. And apparently it was to ward off the disease. And Daniel Defoe writes about people hanging the same sort of charm outside their doors in plague-ridden London. And it seems to have been like a lucky word, which has then been brought onto stage as a magic word for magic tricks.
I never really got the triangle arrangement thing.
No, because that works with any... Because we were talking about this the other day about with some friends of ours. That arrangement of a word works with any word.
Yeah.
You take a word, you remove a letter and like form it into a triangle. That's not a thing that only specific...
It's not Pascal's triangle, is it?
No, it's just not. It's not numbers, any word.
It's almost like numerology is bollocks.
Yeah. You guys mentioned the bullet catch. I was reading up about it a little bit.
It's nowhere near as impressive as the crossbow bolt catch.
No. When do you reckon the first bullet catch was done, Ben?
Okay, I imagine you probably need like a gun with rifling, so you've got a chance of it being more accurate. So, which is probably that's the 17.
I'm just gonna say
it's there
now. We're not actually grabbing a bullet from the air.
I'm just gonna point out that we're not necessarily actually firing the bullet. So the rifle, the accuracy of the shot is probably
incidental to everything going on.
You've just shattered Ben's illusions.
Although I like the logical process that you were going through.
Also, I imagine, because before that, it's sort of ball and shot with a musket and dumping it down. And
that might be part of the method.
That might be part of the method, if you think about it.
Oh, yeah, that's because then you can just palm the ball. In that case...
France in 1586. They probably did not have the most accurate firearms back then. There's an account of it where one of his servants, being angry with him, hit him such a knock with the gun that he killed him. So even then, the first person recorded doing it was being killed carrying it out. It was really popularised in the 1840s by John Henry Anderson, the Great Wizard of the North. He was a Scottish magician. He performed it for P.T. Barnum, for Tsar Nicholas, for Victoria and Albert. And then it sort of fell out of popularity because Chung Ling Soo died performing it in 1918.
Who did?
Yes. Bill. Yes. Mates. William Ellsworth Robinson. Yes. Not at all Chinese.
Very American.
If you see the pictures of him, you go like, wow, he didn't look the least bit Chinese.
The best thing about it was that he was performing in London at the same time as the real Ching Ling Fu, the Chinese version he was copying, which I loved.
And there was, they had a press conference together, and the press tried to build up animosity between the two of them, the fact that he was nicking this Chinese guy's act. Admittedly, because the Chinese guy had put down a bet of $1,000 going, if you can copy my tricks, I'll give it to you. Then they tried to build up all of this heat between them, and the public just went, oh, I don't give a shit. Just want a good show. do you know what Chun Ling Su's final words were?
Oh, I've been shot or something like
that. Oh my God, something's happened, lower the curtain.
Yeah.
I don't think this is spoiling anyone's act. I'm going to realise the way that that trick is done is essentially that there are two powder charges in the rifle. So the bit that they have the barrel where the bullet is, and then they have the bit where you put the ramrod, and that's where the powder was in Chun Ling Su's rifle. So when it fired, over the years, it had just worn down. So the powder in the ramrod casing had leaked through into the main one and lit the main charge of powder. So basically, it did actually fire the bullet because he didn't steal the bullet away. It just they had a duplicate bullet and didn't pack it full. Well, because I think they did that live on stage. They did, and they got someone from the audience to come up and ram it and do it.
To check that the bullet wasn't being stolen away or that sort of thing. It's. I mean, I think the moral of that story is don't do genuinely dangerous tricks.
Well, just don't aim at the magician. Just aim to the side. of the distance you are firing over, no one will know the difference.
Yes, that's true. There was a German guy called Ralph Biala who did it in the 50s. He used to do it for like 2,000 Deutschmarks. You have to pay him to perform the trick. And he'd do,
I mean, you do
it
you have like, to pay us to perform our tricks as well. That is how we make our money.
By special request. Yeah, you'd pay extra. And he'd wore these special gloves and bulletproof glasses, and he had steel front teeth to catch the bullet in his teeth. And it would be shot through 3 panes of glass before he was meant to catch it in his teeth. He was wounded 9 times carrying out the trick. You think after number 8, surely you're going to say, you know, maybe this isn't working.
Back to the doves.
Yeah, back to the doves. But no, he survived. He died.
I mean, if the dove can catch a bullet in its beak, that is really impressive.
Wow, I would love that. Yeah, he died falling off a cliff, apparently, which I don't know why I find that funny, but...
He's overreaching to catch the bullet. Yeah.
It's like the guy who invented Segway, isn't it? He sadly died by backing off a cliff.
Yeah, off a cliff.
On a Segway.
That is...
he was moving out of the way for someone. It's just...
Yes.
Yeah. Very much makes him the patron saint of this podcast.
Talking about people who died on stage, do you know what the Guinness World Record for the longest time being buried alive is?
And then coming out the other side.
Yeah. Otherwise, that's someone we buried.
Someone who was buried 40,000 years ago.
Buried alive for a magic trick or just generally?
Well, yeah, both. Most of the attempts of it have been as sort of a magic trick or a stunt.
I think it's something like 9 days, isn't it?
It's going to be a long period of time.
David Blaine was buried alive for 6 days. There is no official Guinness World Record for being buried alive.
Is it one of those
because it's so dangerous? And there was a guy, a 24-year-old guy called Janaka Basnayake from Sri Lanka, who in 2012 had his family bury him in a pit 3 metres deep with soil and wood. And 7.5 hours later, they dug him up and he'd stopped breathing. And I think Guinness went to that point, maybe we shouldn't have any sort of listing for this thing because people are trying to do this, which is not a good idea. I read a book at a couple of... So going through this, I was trying to try and be a bit, you know... like liberal and find some female magicians, and there weren't a huge number of them, but I found a couple of black magicians. So there was a guy called Black Herman, who also known as Benjamin Rooker, who was an African-American magician in the 20s and 30s, and because he was working under Jim Crow, he's performing mainly to black audiences, but to some white audiences as well. And his big trick was being buried alive, and he'd be buried alive in a town he was then going to perform in, and 3 days later he'd be dug up and would come and do the show for people as sort of a way of rounding up audiences. And at the end of one show, he died of a heart attack, and people were like, nah, this is a stunt.
Yeah, just hung around.
And so his promoters sold tickets to his actual funeral to prove that he had actually really died, and happening.
I mean, in a way, you've got to respect the pure, proper carny aesthetic there of being like, we can probably ticket this.
Yeah, right to the very end.
Also, the brass balls on an African-American in Jim Crow era just going, my big show is that I'm going to be buried alive. Where the KKK going, well, this is brilliant.
Even better, I found a guy called Richard Potter, who's the first successful American stage magician and also a black guy. He was 1783 to 1835, he was alive. And one of his big tricks was walking into an oven with raw meat and staying in it until the meat was cooked, and then he'd walk out again.
That's cool.
That's a great trick.
Really cool, I like that
trick.
That's cool.
Yeah, yeah.
He also pioneered the sous vide form of cooking.
Yeah. I walk into this bath of water with this salmon for 2 to 3 hours.
Yeah. But I'm going to talk, my suggestion for the world's worst magic trick is sawing a person in half. Specifically, the performance by PC Sarkar on BBC TV on April the 9th, 1956.
I mean, this sounds, do tell more.
So, I read a bit about sawing people in half. It seems to have been like a trick that people were talking about for a long time before someone actually did it in public. The first sort of public performance of it was by a guy called P.T. Salbit in January 1921 in Finsbury Park, not far from here. And the first woman to be sawn in half in public, because that's important as well, was a woman called Betty Barker, who was his assistant. And he did it with her completely invisible in a box, but she'd be tied up beforehand and the audience would be holding ropes through holes at either end of the box.
Is that how we do it?
And that's, and like some sort of magic historians seem to be saying like that's the point at which magic sort of changed from the sort of gentleman magician stuff to slightly more grand guignol, a bit gory and macabre. But it was the sort of trick where obviously television was becoming a new technology and it wasn't the sort of thing you'd see very often, particularly on TV. And so this Indian magician called PC Sarkar appeared on obviously television live in 1956 on Panorama to saw in half his 17-year-old assistant, Dipti Day. And he did it with no box. He'd lay on a table and it was a circular buzzsaw over her body and would lower it down. And as the saw was cutting into her with the accompanying sound effects of it, you know, higher pitched screech and all of that, TV host Richard Dimbleby stepped in front of the camera and announced that the show was over. Which obviously is a really bad time to do that.
Yeah.
And the BBC was flooded with people ringing up going, hang on, is the woman dead? What happened? They had to dedicate an operator to handle all the calls that were coming in and going, no, it's fine. They put in a segment in the late night news to reassure viewers that the woman was alive and well and nothing had happened. And even the next day, because newspapers had gone to print, newspapers had headlines, did the magician kill the girl? All of that stuff. Now, Dimbleby had stepped in because the show had overrun and they'd assumed, obviously, that Sarkar had bungled his timings. Coincidentally, the next day, Sarkar was about to start a run of shows in London in the York Theatre, and this slot in Panorama was quite a big sort of chance for publicity. And he, obviously, as a magician, very in control of timings and knowing exactly how long his set was and how long things would take. And his son, and apparently he also suggested, Sarkar and his son have suggested that this was a deliberate ploy, knowing that they would have to cut off the show just at about the point where the soul was entering the woman. And then they genuinely had people showing up at the theatre buying tickets because they wanted to see if she was alive and how it was done for real.
Good work.
That's amazing.
Which is an amazing, like, little bit of publicity. But the reason I pick it for my World's Most Magic Trick is A, because it's sort of one of those cliche tricks, but also that particular performance of it is such a like War of the Worlds radio broadcast moment,
yeah,
causing panic, that I love it so much.
Rob.
Okay, so I was thinking a lot about this, and I've gone for, rather than a specific performance, I'm going for like things that exist in the magical lexicon. To best understand this, you have to understand that there are certain types of magic.
Mm-hmm.
So close-up magic, I think, is something we're all familiar with, guys at tables and stuff.
Yeah.
And then stage magic is, you know, girls in boxes or stuff, or just things done on stage like we do. And then there's a particular type of magic known as manipulation.
Mm-hmm.
And that is your classic, usually person in a tux, producing fans of cards and doves and, mm-hmm. and things. And that form of magic is possibly the most guilty of doing the thing of it is largely performed for other magicians
mm-hmm.
in a competitive format. There are magic competitions for people doing this in the world.
So all those classic, like, with the rings?
Yeah,
things,
like, so
that's one of those.
Linking rings, but even not so much the linking rings. It's largely just making things appear.
Okay.
And then sort of making them disappear again very briefly and then making them reappear again.
Okay.
From, let us say, an elbow or a knee.
Yeah, and the thing's vanished and now it's back and now it's vanished and now there's five of them.
And there are lots of different branches of manipulation. So there's card manipulation, there's umbrellas, there's CD manipulation, which is one of the most heinous things in the world.
It's much more impressive to do with an MP3.
Or a vinyl, or just a cassette tape.
Yeah. I mean, it's basically magic keepy-uppy, isn't it?
Honestly, it is, and it's essentially, and so in manipulation, largely what you get is someone starting out in a slightly oversized and yet seemingly well-fitting suit, who gradually loses weight over the course of their performance.
Yeah. And also gains birds.
And gains birds.
And loses just weight and gains birds. Yeah. That sounds like a cracking model.
That sounds like the most macho fitness regime ever. Lose weight, gain birds.
Yeah, I think I've seen that advert on the side by my Facebook. But, and so it's just this particularly strange thing, whereas Reese once summed it up when watching a manipulator work, that all you're really doing is watching someone slowly make a mess.
As usually, produce a thing,
drop it on the floor. Produce a thing, drop it on the floor.
Produce a thing, confetti falls out, drop it on the floor. Yeah.
You're just largely making a mess of the stage.
My favourite two sort of slight subversions of that are Penn and Teller doing the cup and balls trick with the see-through cups.
Yep. Yes.
Which is beautiful, because it's admitting to what it is, which is just showing off sleight of hand and ability to make things disappear and reappear, but doing it in such a way that the audience get to appreciate really the skill behind it. And then Tommy Cooper's Too Many Bottles. one massive bottle of gin producing thousands and thousands of bottles, increasing amounts of bottles in front of him on the table.
But it was interesting, actually. The bottles routine is a routine that I would argue as a magician, I would argue that that performance is not a magic trick.
Yes.
I would argue that that is a prop gag.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because the joke of that is so much more the focus than the trick. And in fact, actually,
and the joke belies how the trick works.
The joke belies how the trick works. And the best bit of that trick is right at the start, when you produce them and they swap.
Yes.
And then every new bottle increases, makes it increasingly funny, but less and less magical.
Yes, 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 true.
And that you can still see that performance to this day, because magicians have been performing that exact routine since the 50s.
Yeah.
Because obviously entertainment hasn't moved on since the 50s.
We were talking earlier about competition magic, which is a weird thing in itself, in that there are competitions in societies, magic societies, across the world, including FISM, which is the Fédération Internationale Société de Magiciens.
Beautiful.
And there is a European FISM, and then there is an international FISM. And if you win FISM...
Sorry, we're so childish. Yeah.
If you win FISM...
Stop saying FISM.
FISM. then you get crowned World Champion of Magic.
Yeah.
And...
What a title.
And... There are I've broken Ben. And
there are lots of categories for FISM.
And we were judging
FISM all over the place.
We were judging not FISM. We were judging something that definitely wasn't FISM a couple of weeks ago. We were judging
JISM. Sorry, I'm just saying it now to break the spell. Yeah.
we were judging the British Ring competition.
I promise you that is literally what it's called.
So and so, which is the International Brotherhood of Magicians, or the IBM, they have rings all over the world, and we were at the British Ring.
It's better than the Institute of British Sorcerers.
Yeah, it is. And we were some of the judges for that competition. And competition magic is very weird, because you have to decide, am I judging on magic, am I judging on entertainment value? But they are timed competitions, where they have a very specific time limit, and if they exceed that time limit... with 30 seconds to go, they get a really loud and you're just like, this is distracting, and then with time off, literally they'll be taken off the stage
with a giant walking stick.
Better than that, we were at European FISM back in 2011. It was the first magic competition we'd ever watched. We didn't really know much about it. We found the format very weird, but several acts that year overran and the curtain just drops on them. But you can also get the curtain dropped on you if you are deemed to be not a good enough standard.
Oh, wow.
If you're so bad at what you're doing. And so there was an act we were watching, and which was doing some stuff with umbrellas, and then a CD manipulation routine producing CDs as if by magic. And again, I don't think I'm revealing too much, in that a large part of CD manipulation is hiding a CD in your hand in a manner as if it looks like you're not hiding a CD in your hand. Yeah. However, if you're bad at that, it is hiding a CD in your hand in a manner that looks exactly like you are hiding a CD in your hand.
And so this guy was doing these CD manips and sort of producing them and putting them away and producing them and putting them away, kind of jigging along to this music, and had this kind of really sort of big smile on his face and everything. And then the judges just put a red light up, and he didn't see the red light.
There was two little red lights, the corner of the stage that just turn on, which is get off stage.
Like, you're not going to get off stage. And he didn't see that. And so he just carried on. And so the curtain, this is in the Blackpool Winter Gardens Opera House.
Massive
2,000-seat room. The curtain just starts lowering. And he hasn't seen this curtain lowering. And it lowers and lowers and lowers. And he's jigging along and doing his stuff. And then the moment it reaches his eye line, his facial expression goes from really happy to,
Oh. And just completely crestfallen, and the curtain finishes falling. And that was terrible.
But anyway, going back to the, I think, the worst ladder trick in the world, and this is a trick you can see, and in fact that we saw, I think, twice in that competition, and you can see on stages all over the world. So, in Dove Magic, which I generally really like, which is producing doves, and which is a really magical, inherently fantastical thing to happen on stage.
Slightly less popular nowadays.
Because, you know, animal stuff. Rights. Yeah. But that aside...
Then pesky doves.
So, we don't agree... We would never perform Dove Magic, because I don't believe that an animal can consent to being a magic trick. But it is still a really magical thing to watch.
Yeah.
Except that almost every dove act ends with the same trick.
Oh, yes.
And now reason we're talking about
it's awful.
And they will have a cage on a table at the side of the stage. And every time you pull a dove out, you give it a little kiss to show that you care about it, even though it's been stuffed in your jacket for 15 minutes. and you put it in on a little stand in this cage. And almost every dove act ends with the same trick, where what is meant to happen is that that cage full of doves is going to vanish into thin air. And the cage on the table, you put all the doves in, end of trick. The dove, there's a cloth over the cage, which you sort of pull down over the cage.
Yeah.
And then what is meant to happen is that you lift the thing off and you carry it into the middle of the stage and you throw the cloth in the air and the cage has vanished and all the doves have vanished with it.
Yeah.
Being honest, speaking as a magician, that is not what it looks like. What it looks like in every performance of this I've ever seen, I've never seen this look anything other than this. You pull the cloth over the cage on behind this slightly large, slightly fat table.
Yes.
And you grab the top sides of the cage and you step on something at the back of the table. And then every time, in every performance, the middle of the cloth sags. It just sags. In a way that would not happen were you lifting a solid cage.
Well, I've never seen anyone pick it up looking like they're actually holding a cage. Yeah.
And then they do this weird sort of pantomime kind of, oh, walking to the middle of the stage thing.
Yeah.
And then throw it in the air and the cloth falls and the cloth is empty.
Yeah.
And that, in my mind, is the pinnacle of bad magic. Firstly, because it's using animals in a way they can't consent to, in probably what is not a super comfortable situation for the animals where they end up.
Yeah.
And secondly, because it's so clear what it's meant to be. It's so clear what the trick is meant to be. But the execution of that trick never matches up to that.
Yeah.
The execution of you pick up the cage under a cloth and throw it in the air and it's gone never actually looks like that. But magicians are so blind to it because it's such a popular way of finishing your act that no one has ever stopped to say, but does it actually look like we've picked up the cage? Because would a cage really sag in the middle when you pick it up? And that is the thing why I think it's the absolute worst thing, because it's performed everywhere by dove workers all over the world.
Yeah.
But it actually doesn't look like anything. And the only reason the audience claps is because it's such a huge applause cue.
Yeah.
Throwing this thing in the air and basically bowing, that people know to clap, even though it looks so suspicious and looks like nothing on earth has happened.
The opposite would be much more impressive, wouldn't it, surely, if you threw a cloth in the air and it turned into doves.
Exactly, or if there are so many other things you can end a bird act on, and like lots of people end on producing a huge, like a parrot or an owl, there are like amazing...
The
animal
smashing,
rights violations.
The old smashing the cage thing like in The Prestige.
Like in The Prestige, like all that kind of stuff.
If you're a bird magician and you've got 15 doves stuffed up your sleeve, how much guano is up there at the end of a trick?
So the worst thing about working with bird magicians is that obviously they have all their birds backstage and birds stink.
Yeah.
Birds really stink.
Especially when you realise that a dove is just a white pigeon.
It's just a pigeon.
Oh, God, yeah.
It's just a well-turned-out pigeon.
Yeah, well-turned-out, very plain. You can twist its head around and hopefully not kill it by mistake. The impressive thing would be a cat magician. You can hide cats up your sleeves.
And get them to do what they're meant to do.
Yeah.
Was it Careers Got Talent about 6 years ago, 7 years ago? Producer Chow?
Yeah.
So there's the old classic sort of kids party trick of the dove pan, which is
metal pan, and you light something and fire in it and put a lid on, and then there's a dove in there.
In kids parties it's often a birthday cake or sweets or something like that. A guy on, I think it was Careers Got Talent, about 7 or 8 years ago, had a dove pan that was about a meter across, and had two people lift the lid on it, put the lid down, lifted it up, and there was an enormous dog that then just kind of clambered out. But it was also an enormous dog that was incredibly fluffy. So he had the right idea of when the dog got out, it looked even bigger than it was. One of these dogs that basically is a walking afro kind of thing.
Okay, so Rob, your choice is. The manipulation of not just the manipulation of doves, making doves in a cage.
Specifically, the vanishing dove cage.
Yeah. The vanishing
it's
dove
the worst
cage.
Magic, I think.
Reese, time for your magician's confession time.
Again, mine is a specific trick rather than a genre. Mine is a specific trick that people still do quite regularly at the moment. And there are many forms out there that you can buy, and it's a trick that is known as the Sands of the Desert.
Oh, God.
And
you know what? I don't know what the trick is. I may not know it when you describe it. But so, from the name alone, I fucking hate it.
So it's called Sands of the Desert, and it is a trick whereby someone stands on stage with a bowl full of water, which often you find in deserts,
yep.
And you have three, usually champagne flutes or something like that, because they look pretty, full of three different brightly coloured sands.
Usually, as you often find in deserts.
Usually blue, pink and yellow. And they then proceed to dip their hands in the water and swirl it around, and the water turns inexplicably black.
Yep.
So you can't see through the water anymore. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right, okay. Let's see where this is going. They then pour those three sands in, mm-hmm. and again swirl their hands around a bit, and then dip their hands in, and one by one pull out handfuls of coloured sand, which is dry and is the same colour, and put it back into the glasses, and then they swirl their hands again, and the water turns clear. Now, the one thing I hate in magic is that idea of, this is a magic trick because I am doing something in order to undo it.
Yeah.
That is, it's like the linking rings. I link the rings and then I unlink them and then everything is fine.
But admittedly, if you're sawing someone in half, you better be doing it to then put them back together again.
But so the thing
it
is,
would be better if they didn't.
So the thing with magic is that sawing someone in half, the trick there is really, it's not splitting someone in half because that's not a magical thing to happen. The only magical bit is putting that person back together. Otherwise, you are literally just killing someone. But so the trick there is only the bringing back together. That is the only trick there. Whereas if I take three...
The defence rests, my lord.
If I take three unequal lengths of rope,
yeah.
and one's short and one's medium and one's long, mm-hmm. and then I muck about with them in my hands and I pull them, and now they're all the same length.
That's a magic trick.
The magic trick has already happened.
I don't need to put them back.
I don't need to put them back to the original sizes.
Yeah.
I've already done a magic trick.
If I take two solid steel rings and people examine them and then I link them, I don't need to unlink them. That was a magic trick. With Sands of the Desert, the process of getting everything mixed in order to unmix them, you need to do that process because arguably the only bit of the magic is the unmixing.
Yeah.
But the mixing's rubbish, isn't it? Let's be honest. So the first thing is, often in magic you have to do things undercover because you can't see everything that's going on. But my first question is, why does the water turn black?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Other than chemistry. Second question... Yeah. How do we know that they're mixed when you pour them in? Because the water's black and swishing your hands around is one thing, but you can't see that they're mixed. You never see that happen.
Yeah.
Third thing is, when you pull them out, why are they dry? And why are they not wet? And fourth thing is, why do I care? Like, just the entire thing is a nonsense. It's a nonsense pantomime that doesn't make any sense. And also, especially in the last sort of 20, 25 years ago when the trick was sort of very popular... The kind of the scientific explanation behind it was not necessarily widely known. But when you walk into what used to be Woolworths or wherever JML advertises these days, and they're kind of like, you know, oh, look, you can buy some magic sand and stuff like that. When you've got that blaring at you, surely the trick is now obvious to absolutely anyone.
In fact, I think it's been on QI.
It frustrates me that people will stand on stage and do this for upwards of 7 or 8 minutes. And again, just something that you can buy off the shelf and do all these motions and everything and throwing the sand around. And it's just nothing. It doesn't mean anything. It doesn't do anything.
It also falls into that classic category of magic trick where, again, magicians often confuse their abilities in that magicians think that because they know how to do a magic trick, they are either a brilliant comedian. So there are a lot of magicians out there that often take things like... I mean, the sign of a really good show is if you could like take the magic tricks out and it'd still be a funny show. Mm-hmm. I've never seen a magic... Despite the number of shows that claim it, I've never seen a magic show that would pass as a comedy show.
Yeah.
People are there to see magic tricks.
It would be like you saying, sign of a good show is if I could take all the funnies out and people still think
take
it's
all
magic.
The jokes out.
it's just like, it's not a comedy show then, is it?
Yeah.
It's not, that's the...
No, but it'll certainly get nominated for an award.
Oh! Smackdown!
Oh. Sorry, I just...
There we leave Westwood Forward. Ben Vanderbilt, who died today.
Yeah, although you're doing the Richard Dimble bit.
Yeah.
People are going to be queuing up for my show tomorrow night.
Magicians confuse getting laughs in their show with being a comedian.
Yeah.
And similarly, magicians confuse doing magic necessarily with being like a professionally trained dancer or performer. And so they'll just do this like ridiculous titting about to music. Like, it looks amazing. I was like, it looks like you're titting about to music, throwing sand around.
I think the danger is, particularly I think in magic and comedy, is because we get such an, when it goes well, such an obvious reward. Like, I get laughter. You don't just get applause, you get like amazement and wonder, which obviously if you're a very good actor, you can get those as well, but it's not top of the list. Same with being a dancer, same with being I don't know, any other kind of public speaker or performer. Our two forms of entertainment are predicated on a particular reaction, and because we get that reaction so often, it can make us cocky and have bad judgment about what's good.
Absolutely. And the difference with magic is that,
and it makes you reach for that reaction,
and try for it. And magicians often aren't even doing their own material. A lot of magicians are basically covers bands.
Yeah.
So it'd be like a comedian going out there thinking he's an amazing comedian, doing someone else's joke, like entirely someone else's jokes, and then also going on about what an incredibly moving show he'd written because, you know, he's just done
Dad's
someone
just died.
Yeah, exactly.
I always think if I find a mark of a good magic trick is I look at it and I go, I don't think that could be more impressive. Whereas thinking of the sand thing, I would go, that would be more impressive if you, say, got an audience member to reach in and take the sand out.
Or mix the sand beforehand.
Don't do it without the black stuff.
Get rid of the water.
Yeah.
If you had a pile in front of you, I've got blue sand, I've got green sand, I've got yellow sand, I'm going to throw them into this pile, I'm going to shake it up, look, you can see it's mixed.
And
then you raise a cover or whatever, and you dip your hand in, you pull out a handful of blue sand, a handful of green sand, a handful of yellow sand, and then you tip the thing up and it's empty. That's a much better trick.
Literally doing it in a bucket would be a better trick. And it is that sense of a sign of a bad magic trick is things that happen, and the only reason they happen is because you need to make that happen for the trick to work.
Yeah.
Why does the water turn cloudy? If the water doesn't turn literally black, then
you'll see how the trick works. And you go, well, that tells me how the trick works.
So why is the water in it? Oh, because don't you see? Because if sand's wet, then how is it dry afterwards? Yeah, but isn't the trick mixing things? But mixing wet sand is more impressive than mixing dry sand. Have we now got four things competing for one trick, none of which are any good?
I sort of feel like you guys need to do a revisionist magic show where you successfully make a cage full of doves disappear with their consent. That's the really impressive bit.
Get them to sign a form.
Just give them two cages and let them pick which one they go into.
Oh no, surely the start of it, you've got to be doing manipulation where you make the doves' consent forms appear and disappear, and then you've got to like mix sand without water.
Yeah.
Your housing business is really not going well.
One of the ways we write magic tricks, because we've written a lot of magic tricks over the years, is genuinely looking at magic tricks we think are terrible and going, well, can you remove all of the terrible stuff?
We wrote a trick specifically in reaction to the fact that there is a popular magic trick in Mentland called the book test, where you give someone a book and they have to pick a word from that book and you tell them what that word is.
The problem with that trick is that you give them a book to think of a word.
Yeah.
But I can think of many words right now. I've got a reasonable lexicon at my disposal.
Yeah.
And I can go for some unusual words. I can go for some pretty usual words. We can have all in between. Why do I need a book to help me? Oh, because it makes it random. Well, it doesn't make it random. It makes it contained within a very specific subset that you've defined.
Yeah.
So we wrote a trick where the book you give them is a very normal, and they could take it home with them if they didn't cost 20 quid a copy, copy of the Oxford English Dictionary.
Yeah. And Darren Brown did a version of that. Was it with Ian McEwan or someone?
I did it in the British Library.
That's
the pinnacle of a book.
That's the best book ever. Because it is, literally, this is every word ever written.
Yes.
Go and find any book, pick any word.
It's a sentence, wasn't it? Start reading, or whatever.
And I'll tell you how.
Because then the book has purpose, because it's not just you're picking a word, you're picking... You're picking an arrangement of words specific to a book in the room. That then has a reason for the book to exist.
And rather than the book being, I want you to pick a random word, so I'm going to give you a book that I have brought with me myself that I clearly own. Here's every word ever written.
Yeah. So you really could pick any word. The bag of books at the front of the show.
Yes, that was amazing. So we went to a show in Edinburgh many years ago. I'm not going to name the magician, but he was old and dreadful.
What a double act they were.
And his clever idea to get round the whole it's your book thing was that he had a clear plastic bag of books at the front of the stage. And be like, sometimes people bring a book to donate. And so here are those books. And be like,
Can we donate any then?
Yeah, is that a thing that happened? Which is again that classic mistake magicians make of going, oh, I need a reason to have the book. I'll just say that people bring me books. And never go, does that make sense?
It seems like from what you're saying, really important part of magic is the narrative's got to be right.
Well, the thing with magic is that a lot of people when writing magic or performing magic forget that really a magic trick should make a narrative sense. Mm. Even if that sense is, you know... So if the sense is you pick a card and you write your name on the card and then the card goes back in the deck and I destroy the deck or something.
Then
surely the way that the card comes back should relate in some way to something we've been talking about, or some way, maybe the way that we destroy the deck. So,
rather than the cards in that lemon over there, in that bowl of fruit. No, in this lemon,
the lemon
I
brought
carry.
With me. I brought a lemon with me and the card inside.
It's like the best storytelling, the best sort of improv. Even if the audience don't know that that's what they want to happen, when it happens, you go, yes, that's what I wanted to happen.
Good magic, the audience should be ahead of you.
Yeah.
So when you start to do the reveal, in good magic, the audience go, I've just worked out where the card's going to be.
Yeah.
It can't be there
because that's impossible, but it must be there.
It's like sometimes when you're doing stand-up or improv, if the audience are ahead of you, then it's the fun of how you get them to laugh.
Yeah.
Which is fun and magic. I mean, I remember a magic trick that you two did on me, which is, I assume, similar to the word guess, which still baffles me to this day, is that you guessed all of the numbers on my bank card. With unless you were planning
in
to
order
do
or
that,
just you know oh, no, they no, named in, nine numbers
in order
zero one
yeah
two, there's a two in there somewhere and the name B Vanderveld, I think somewhere around there.
Yeah, and then you use those numbers that you remember to order quite a lot.
So that trick, for example, so that's sort of one of our signature pieces we've done on TV. And basically, the trick there is that we usually start with coins. And we have a glass, and Reese is looking away or getting someone to hold his eye line. And we drop coins in a glass one by one. And Reese goes, that's a 20p, that's a 50p, that's a pound. And then we'll do like a handful of change.
I'll say that's £3.74.
Yeah, that's fun.
And then
coins from people's pockets.
Yes, then we'll get a bank card from someone.
Yes.
And we'll drop it in a glass.
I'll say it's a Visa card.
And I'll drop it in a glass again.
It's from Lloyd's.
And then I'll drop it in a glass again and I'll give you the number from the card.
I'll give you the number of the card.
That's pretty cool.
And the narrative sense of the trick is I have got an incredible sense of hearing and I can tell what coins are, and then you push it to the absurd.
Yeah.
And I can also tell what bank cards are. Because obviously that can't, like, you can vaguely believe
that someone
might be able to do it with coins, and then the handful of coins is like, that's on the edge of believability, and the bank card is like, it's just nonsense, isn't it? It's a magic trick.
The next thing is get them to write a check, and then keep the check.
Exactly.
You drop an Apple phone in and you work out how much they paid on Apple Pay last time.
You will occasionally get someone in the audience go, do the lot, because they're ahead of us.
Great.
Which is perfect, because then you just go,
All right then.
£7.22. Because if you're following a narrative arc, it should make sense, and the magic trick should make sense.
Yeah.
Whereas if you take some water and wave your hands on it so it goes dark, and then tip coloured sand into it,
people are going, what?
No
are they
one
doing?
Knows what's going to happen. No what one's there going, doing? Well, obviously, he's now going to take the same coloured sand out again.
Make a chocolate cake. Bake it in an oven, take it out, reach inside, and pull out a Dairy Milk.
Yeah.
That's the version of that trick I want to see done. And like two eggs and a bag of flour.
Yeah.
Now you've got to bake a chocolate cake, take it out of the oven, and pull out Mary Berry's passport. I began by looking at magic that would really annoy me. And there is a type of magic called gospel magic.
Oh, yes, there is.
Now, listeners of this podcast, amongst whom I hope there are not many evangelical Christians, will know that...
Who are also magicians.
Because they manage to make money disappear out of the accounts of very poor congregants. We'll know that often I go to Pentecostalist Christianity as a source of many of the things in the world that annoy me. But basically, the way gospel magic works is it is used to present the good news of the Bible via visual parables. It was invented by Giovanni Melchiorre Bosco, who actually sounds like a sort of alright guy. He was an Italian Catholic priest working sort of the turn of the century. And he's known as the patron saint of Catholic magic. I mean, I frankly thought that was Jesus, but there we are.
But he worked as a juggler, a magician, and an acrobat. And
I can turn the water into wine, but first of all, the water has to be completely black.
Squid wine. And he basically tried to... The lovely thing that he did was sort of... and he seemed like quite a lovely man, was to get children off the street and entice them into the good work of the church. You know, come on.
Okay.
He would get kids off the streets and sort of introduce them to the word of God via magic.
How?
By
would he do one of those really tedious card stories with, I was walking down the street the other day, King Street, in fact, and I walked past four ladies, that one of those ones, and one of them said, can have you talk about Jesus? Yeah. You can call him Jack, because there isn't a Jesus card.
Sam the Bellhop was pretty high on my list.
On the worst
well.
Magic tricks ever,
that trick you've described that is, trick. Called, is called Sam the Bellhop.
That's how it is, yeah.
Well, because the premise of that trick is that I'm shuffling these cards, and yet I know the order, so I'm clearly not shuffling them.
Yeah, yeah.
Trick over.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you've just ruined Ricky Jay for me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So there's him, and he's the whole notion of it is very, very infuriating. But that took me down a different rabbit hole to a gentleman called Smith Wigglesworth.
Brilliant. That is the best name ever.
Yes, it is.
Is he a bunny from a children's book?
No, that's Wigglesworth Smith.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And he's actually a caterpillar.
Yeah. Yeah.
But then he's got an amazing magic trick. Where
he eats loads and loads and loads and then gets really, really big. And yeah, the next day he's really small again.
Then he's there for 3 days. Yeah. And then he rises again and then ascends. And oh, God, we've gone full circle.
Well, yeah, we absolutely have. Yeah, caterpillar Jesus.
Yeah. Christless.
It goes in the
yes. Yes.
Good, we've peaked.
Out of the trough.
Strapping everyone, we're going downhill. He was one of the first faith healers to work in the United Kingdom. And obviously these gentlemen, and they're pretty much always gentlemen, as well as being confidence tricksters, they are using techniques of cold reading, and perhaps bits of sleight of hand to try and persuade people that they are helping them get better, or they're reading their thoughts or connecting them with the other side. He was from Yorkshire, and he originally worked as a plumber. And
was a lot of his cold reading. You recently had your taps done.
If you wanted to be a hot reading, I'm going to have a look at
He was incredibly talented, for want of a better word, and his talent took him all around the world, to America, to India, to Australia, to South Africa. He was actually banned in Sweden, or banned from laying on of hands in Sweden, for a reason I couldn't quite work out. So instead, he created something called corporate healing, where his patients would lay the hands on themselves and would heal themselves, which I know sounds like a get-out-of-jail-free
card. Is it on webcam?
Oh, mate, if that doesn't exist, then it will by the end of this podcast.
Oh, my God, that's such a brilliant... I mean, it's an awful, brilliant, genius idea. Yeah.
There will be people who would sign up for that.
Yeah,
so right.
There must be.
But because he was working at a time when there were credulous people who believed this sort of thing, he would also sell prayer handkerchiefs, where you could use the handkerchief to heal yourself. He even sent one to King George V. But my favourite thing about him is that he'd punch people.
Oh, no.
So there is a story of how a gentleman would come on stage with stomach cancer, and he responded by punching him in the stomach.
Oh.
And his defence was...
Punch the cancer right out of it.
Yeah, I don't hit them. I hit the devil in them.
Oh, brilliant. No. He sounds like just the sort of guy that Houdini would have hated.
Well, quite.
Are you going to talk about Houdini?
I'm not going to talk about Houdini at all.
Because that was like late 19th, early 20th century. He was all about myth-busting. If he was alive today, he would be a host of myth-busters, hands down.
So he was sort of like the Derren Brown of his day.
Yeah, he hated spiritualists and all of the... Arthur Conan Doyle fell out over the whole belief in fairies and spiritualism and belief in ghosts.
Arthur Conan Doyle believed the tricks he was doing were real.
Yeah, he told Houdini that he was a genuine magician. Houdini's like, I'll show you how I can do it.
There is an account of Houdini and Conan Doyle in a car, and Houdini shows Conan Doyle a magic trick, and Conan Doyle says, see, you have otherworldly, ungodly, like superhuman powers. And so this is not brilliant for a podcast, but this is that I'm going to show you the magic trick that Houdini showed Conan Doyle to elicit this response.
Okay.
No word of a lie. Oh, that wow. is the trick.
Well, I mean, people at home, it's the thumb trick.
It's the pulling your thumb apart.
Good.
The basic trick.
Lords.
Other interesting facts about Houdini. You know, he was the first man
to fly a plane in Australia.
That might not be true. I've seen really? That as well. Some people credit him with it. Apparently, some other guy done it a few months earlier. But there's some different definitions of what the flight is.
If anyone is going to fudge the dates and fix that, it's going to be Houdini. His best skill, more than escapology, was branding.
Yeah. There was definitely another guy trying to do it at the same time because Australia was the last continent on which manned flight had not yet been committed.
There's a whole thing about how high they were and how long it was
and which of them is the most effective, whether it's a flight or a jump.
He died after getting punched in the stomach as well. But it may not have been because he was punched in the stomach. He had... Apparently he had appendicitis.
Yeah, they think it brought on a premature rupture.
But also he wouldn't have known. He'd have gone, oh, I'm a bit sore in my stomach. That's probably from the punch, rather than going, oh, maybe this is appendicitis. Yeah.
But the point of him being punched in the stomach, it was basically, check out my abs.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah, but he was lying down at the time and hadn't prepared.
It's like Blaine did it, where he got punched twice in a row by Kimbo Slice.
Yeah. Friend of the show, Kimbo Slice. We talked about him here before.
It's an amazing piece of footage because Blaine is standing there. And it's a trick you can learn, but you really have to prepare for it.
And you also have to be nuts.
You have to be mad.
Blaine is lovely.
And so Blaine stands there and pulls his shirt up and says, just punch me as hard as you want in the stomach. And Kimbo Slice punches him and then goes, would you like to do it again? And everyone loses their minds because he barely even flinches.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Would you like to punch me again?
His insurers paid out double indemnity after that because they definitely said, oh, the punch killed him. So they paid out double what they should have done because it was a death bite.
David Blaine.
Houdini.
He's still going.
David Blaine is still with
him. Although Kimbo's life isn't, so
maybe that's what happened. Maybe David Blaine punched him back. If that is not a conspiracy theory.
Amazing. Speaking of coming back from the dead, after Houdini died, he told his wife, or just before he died, not after he died, before he died, he told his wife that, listen, there's no such thing as ghosts. If there is, I will communicate with you after my death, and I'll communicate the words Rosabelle Believe. So their favourite song was Rosabelle, and you say Rosabelle Believe. That was their like secret thing. They only knew about it. She held a seance for 10 years after his death. He died on Halloween.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
And they do seances
in the Magic Castle. Yes.
Yeah. She did it for 10 years and then stopped. And she said, look, 10 years is long enough to wait for any man.
Lovely. Well, apparently the Beatles have that as well. They had an agreement between themselves that if any of them die, then they'll send a message back from the great beyond. And so far they are 0 for 2. or 0 for 3 if you believe the Paul is dead rumours. I far too often go into the world of bullshit faith healing. So instead I'm going to tell you the story of Jasper Maskelyne.
Hey.
Do you know about this chap?
We know who the Maskelynes are, yes.
Yeah. So the Maskelynes are a great magic dynasty. His father and grandfather, Neville and John Neville, were luminaires of the British magic scene.
They're talking candlesticks.
And Jasper continued this great dynasty. There's a 1937 Pathé newsreel of a very, very dapper, waxed-moustached Jasper Maskelyne performing various tricks, including the old razor blade out of the mouth trick. But he was a man who was waiting for World War II so he could shine. He signed up and joined the Royal Engineers, and he told them that his skills in misdirection and smoke and mirrors could help them with camouflage during the war. He was, you will be unsurprised to learn, a man quite full of pomp and self-belief. Yeah. He said, I've had a lifetime of hiding things on stage. I can tell you more about hiding rabbits and tigers than you will ever know.
Don't hide them together.
Or do you hide them really well.
Yeah, that's a trick that Noah learned.
You reach into the tiger shit and pull out the live rabbit again.
Again, see, narrative resolution.
So he was signed up for them. His first big commission was a Brigadier Clark made him part of the A-Force deception team. And basically they were stationed outside Cairo and his mission was basically to deceive the German army as to what they actually saw was there. So he had 14 assistants, including an architect, an art restorer, a carpenter, a chemist, an electrical engineer, an electrician,
and a partridge painter, in a
tree, which was hiding inside a cage that he threw up in the air and disappeared very unsatisfactorily. They were known as the Magic Gang.
The talking dog got most of the press.
Yeah, but don't listen to the talking dog because it didn't say any of the shit that it said it did.
the Magic Gang's top secret mission was to make another Alexandria a mile down the coast from the real Alexandria so that the Germans would bomb that one instead. And they'd even planned a sort of a before and after. So he'd painted a huge canvas that was full of fake craters and things like that.
Yeah.
And this already this sounds like a Goon Show episode. Here's the thing, and this will become quite a common thread through Maskelyne's career. There's a good chance that this did happen, and it what did trick the Germans. But there's also a good chance that Maskelyne had fuck all to do with it.
Yeah, a lot of the stuff I've read about him was like he wrote. There's a book by an official biographer, and he's written his own memoirs, and there's a few others, and it's all I did all of this, and I had personal meetings with Monty and all of this stuff. And there's going to be a film, but there's been a film about him in production for ages.
Which is again the classic thing I was talking about earlier of magicians genuinely do have a habit of getting ahead of themselves and think that they are some sort of superhuman.
Yeah,
and it happens nowadays, even not just with faith healers, with mind readers doing shows about. How to improve your life.
Yeah.
Or being keynote speakers at advertising conferences.
Like, Paul McCann here, guys.
Yeah. Honestly, and they'll be like, you know, in my show I influence people and do that. It's like, but you don't.
Yeah.
You're lying. That's not true. It'd be like us giving a talk at an aviation conference because we know how to make things float.
Yes.
And going, well, I float things all the time in my show, so I'm going to be the keynote speaker at this aviation conference.
So if you can get a really, really long piece of quite high tensile strength thread.
Yeah.
And sort of a winched point. I don't know, somewhere. Let's say the ISS.
Yeah.
He was also part of Operation Bertram, where he had to try and distract the Nazis and make them think that the troops were coming from a different direction. And to do that, apparently, he used trucks disguised as tanks and 2,000 inflatable dummy tanks.
That they definitely existed. And Bertram was a real thing. That was before El Alamein.
So yes,
they
wanted
to think the attack was coming from the south and it came from the north.
There wasn't an American ski group that did a lot of it.
I think so.
There was a group of American soldiers who were trained in alpine skiing, essentially.
Yes.
And they would go ahead over the Alps and in lines and get around the other side and use big loudspeakers and things to create the illusion that they were coming from one direction at night when everything, to hide the fact that the army was advancing on the other side.
The army did that for, the Allies did that before D-Day as well. It was like Operation Franklin, I may be misremembering the name, but it's something like that where they pretended they were going to land at Calais.
And lots of radio stuff and were using... sort of informants in Germany who are double agents who are tipping off they're going to land.
And they dumped a dead tramp dressed up as a British Army officer with some plans on the beach in Belgium, I think.
That's amazing.
Just a guy they found on the street.
The problem with all of this, though...
That is the most heroic tramp of all time.
Yeah,
by
might,
the
right?
It is.
Yeah.
The world's best tramp. The problem with all this, though, is that, especially with the Maskelyne kind of like, and we did this and we did this, is that much like the whole eating carrots radar thing with the pilots, is that magicians are used to lying about how well things went, and so are governments during wartime.
Yeah.
So, and if you've spent a whole bunch of money getting the Magic Gang to disguise Alexandria or something, the point is that you're not going to say, and this was a huge waste of time.
All those there are
Path and News reports about all this amazing stuff they're doing to win the war and these clever ideas to do that, fox the Germans. Even though I think there's not actually a great deal of evidence that any of this stuff works properly.
Well, exactly. Yeah. But also, in the 1940s, I would sort of find that quite comforting if I was back in Blighty finding out that we've got the finest minds in light entertainment trying to defeat Nazism. Like, what's next is, like...
you never get Path of News where they go, we've sent our best hula hoopers!
Quite spoilt for choice here. The four options are PC Sawcar.
PC Sawcar, sawing an assistant in half.
Yeah.
Being interrupted by Richard Dimbleby.
Rob suggested the dove disappearing trick. Reese, the risible sands of the desert. And mine is essentially Jasper Maskelyne's entire military career. Ooh, it's tricky. Now, I'm...
We've avoided it.
Gosh, I'm so sorry.
Sorry, Ben. It's been taken out and shot.
That is, but I caught the bullet between my teeth. So I'm not going to choose your dove disappearing trick.
Because you hate animals.
Because I absolutely loathe them. I really do. I'm still impressed by the mechanics of it working, even though it's just a joke. Oh, I'm dead to Rob. There's something old-timey and classy about it that I quite like. I would love to choose PC Sawcar purely
because it sort of fits in my mind of the BBC being too prissy about not wanting to show stuff. But it's such an amazing piece of self-promotion that he then sold it the next few days. It's not a great trick, but it's a good piece of showbiz. I mean, Jasper Maskelyne is an astonishing self-mythologizer. But it's sort of up in the air that some of these tricks might have worked to help win the war effort, even if he didn't do it. So, Rhys, from the moment you said the word Sons of the Desert, certainly me and Barry were infuriated with the name of it. I'll level with you, I thought the trick was going to be more racist than you said it was.
Oh, there's plenty of other magic tricks that are.
It's got no reason to exist. And actually, the fact that it goes, I'm going to do a trick, but first I'll make the water black. It's the equivalent of me as an eight-year-old walking out the room and then walking back in again. That we're going to go for your professional judgment, and the sands of the desert will be scattered on the floor of the world's of the Worst Foot Forward Museum. So, before we go, the world's worst news. This is a gentleman, it's from a couple of months ago, but a gentleman has been arrested and has been jailed for up to 20 years for trying to smuggle 3 live king cobras into the United States. In Pringle tins.
Amazing. What's he going to do? That magic trick where he opens the lid and they say,
Did he coil them up before they went in?
Yeah, and he did.
Oh, that's a weird metaphor, trying to get a flaccid king cobra into a Pringle tin.
But the important thing is he did have the king cobra's consent before they went in. So he also tried to smuggle 3 Chinese albino softshell turtles. And essentially they were the patsies because the authorities let the softshell turtles through just to check that he was doing what he was doing. And then when the cobras came over, the authorities got on him.
How did he smuggle the softshell turtles? What were they in?
I presume...
Like, were they in like a milk tray box?
No, it was Pop-Tarts. Oh, yeah. So, gentlemen, before we go, where can people find you over the next few months and what can they find you doing there?
Oh, all over the place. We're touring. If you go to morganandwest.co.uk, then all of the list of our tour dates are up. We've been to Manchester and Cheltenham and Ponte Dawi. Next week we're to Bridport and other places. Mm. I'll be honest, I wish I knew. I don't know.
We go where the sat-nav tells us.
I checked the day before.
That's you absolute mercenaries. Yeah. Well, that is it, ladies and gentlemen. We hope that we have not revealed too much behind the veil. We're all off to saw a king cobra in half and actually believe that we can do it.
Yeah.
Until next time, bye-bye. So, that was Morgan and West.
Rhys and Rob.
Rhys and Rob. That felt like one of the most informative pods we've done.
Yeah, it's really nice having them lift the curtain and let us see the man behind it. What was his name anyway? No, thank you to the boys for doing that. And do check out their website and find out if they're coming to a town near you. Follow us.
Yes, please.
We're on Twitter, because we're cool. At WorstFoot on Facebook. Look up WorstFoot Forward and drop us an email, worstfootforwardpodcast@gmail.com.
Yeah, we had, after Rich Soames' episode, we did ask some of you to send in your least favourite words, and we got some good ones.
Yes.
So if you have some least favourite words that you'd like us to be aware of, send them on with the hashtag #blin.
Or indeed, if you've got least favourite magic acts you've seen, send us some YouTube videos.
Yeah, on hashtag Chris Angel. Hashtag Chancer. If you enjoy our business, you know the drill. Pop on iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcast platform of choice. Leave us a 5-star review, say a couple of lovely sentences about us, and then recommend us to your family and classmates.
Sorry, I'm having a little moment here, but I've just looked to my right and seen that the dinosaurs which sit on the windowsill in my flat, the T-Rex is currently rimming a Diplodocus.
We'll take a photo of that and post it. Just yeah. Anyone who's listened, anyone who's actually listened this far into the podcast, this one's a little one just for you. Our guest next week. We're kind of continuing our little variety run because from magic to burlesque, we're joined by my friend Lolo Brow, who is one of the finest burlesque performers in the UK at the moment, and full of dirty, salacious stories and wonderful tales and titillation. She's going to talk to us about the world's worst burlesque act, so join us then.
You will never look at an elephant the same way again.